Kremlin is calling up 300,000 Russians to fight in Ukraine, an ambitious goal that might not even make much of a difference on the battlefield.
They're planning on training them for 2 weeks. That is not enough time. So this is not going to be a capable force. It is not going to be a motivated force.
Also today, President Biden speaks at the UN and sends a multilateral warning to Russia.
We will stand in solidarity with Ukraine. We will stand in solidarity against Russia's aggression, period.
I'm Marco Werman. Plus, they may be a nuisance, but ants perform critical roles keeping our planet in balance. Some scientists wanted to know just how many are out there.
It's not only important how many species you have, the sheer number of the ants also matter.
Just how many? The numbers will blow you away. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. A whole lot to get to on the show today, but we begin with Russia. That's Russian President Vladimir Putin on state TV this morning in Moscow. He was announcing a call-up of troops to fight in Ukraine, 300,000 reservists. Western leaders are calling it an escalation of the Russian invasion of its neighbor. To hear Putin describe it, it's all about the defense of the motherland. The Kremlin is also saying that it will hold snap referendums on whether to annex four occupied regions of eastern Ukraine. Joining me now to discuss all of this is Dara Masiko, a senior policy researcher at the RAND Corporation. 300,000 more soldiers, Dara, it sounds like a lot. What was your first thought when you heard this number?
Well, my first thought was being unsurprised and yet surprised at the same time. They've been laying the groundwork for this sham referendum and annexation for months, and we've known they've had very severe personnel problems. But to wake up here in America and hear 300,000, it's an unpleasant surprise.
Yes. So how will the Kremlin find 300,000 troops? How skilled will they be, and how long is it going to take before they're ready to be on the front lines?
I think what they'll probably try to do is tackle this in small pieces. So yesterday, the defense minister said that they would only be ingesting people with prior combat experience and certain technical skills. That's not a large pool of people. Already, they're sending out summons. They're planning on training them for 2 weeks. That is not enough time. And put them inside Ukraine. So this is not going to be a capable force. The morale problems that are existing on the front lines are not going to be resolved by the new additions.
So we've heard that each region of Russia, these oblasts, would have a different number of people mobilized. Where are these 300,000 people going to come from?
So this is basically done on population density, although I would imagine, based on precedent, that a lot of these reservists are not going to come from the Moscow and St. Petersburg areas. They'll come from more rural areas.
And why is that?
I don't know. I suspect it has to do with protests in the street. That's my assumption.
Can you talk more about that? What would that really happen, do you think, given kind of the paranoid state of things in Russia right now?
Protests in the streets is probably not likely, being that they've carefully couched their language as people who have previously served and people with technical experience. They're trying not to create this kind of mass instability that you might see if they announced a larger mobilization of all military-aged males.
And for Russians who are, you know, very concerned about this announcement and they might be leaving, how is that working? Are they trying to leave the country right now kind of a la Americans to Canada during Vietnam?
I don't have a lot of insights. I have some anecdotes that flights are sold out, different types of Google searches are spiking, like how to leave from Russia. But I don't have insights on how massive that problem is. These are quiet decisions that individual families make. This is when you start seeing things like train rides out of the country. This is where you start to see bribes at the border. If they have cash on hand, they try to bribe their local commissariat to get out of it.
Yeah, I also saw that Google searches for how to break your arm at home also spiked after this announcement. I mean, that kind of suggests that people who don't have the money to leave might try other, even more severe means to get out of this draft.
I think we're probably about to see a lot of the what I call the old ways to get out of being pressed into service like this reemerge. Another one is to pretend that you have a mental illness. These kind of things I suspect we'll be seeing.
So, Dara, bottom line, how will this call-up of reservists change the battlefield strength of Russia in Ukraine?
my assessment is that it's going to take several months for this to have a meaningful impact on the battlefield. And right now, the Russian military is the most vulnerable that it's going to be. And I suspect that will probably continue through the end of the year. They are likely able to generate small groups of individual, infantry type capabilities and try to put them into the front lines. But in terms of generating battalion tactical groups, that process is going to take a long time. And if they rush it, it's certainly not going to have any type of combat capability.
We know that there will be these snap elections in each of four parts of eastern Ukraine now occupied by Russia, a referendum on whether they should be annexed by Russia. Western leaders are already calling it a sham election. Putin said the vote would be protected. Can you help us picture what the vote would actually look like?
These things are always theater. They're already predetermined, so it's all very choreographed. You'll see people raising their hands, and a large majority will be confirmed, and then there'll be some signing ceremonies, the same way they did with Crimea.
Dara, I want us to hear a little more of Putin's speech, a troubling part of it from today. Putin is speaking here about weapons of destruction, and the implication is that these are nuclear weapons. And then he says this. That translates as, I am not bluffing. So, Dara, it's a question the world has been asking since Putin first waved the threat of nuclear weapons near the start of the invasion. But we now see he's up against a wall with the war and cornered. So I have to ask again, is he bluffing? How high is the risk that Putin would use nuclear weapons?
So Russia is going back in time to what it did in 2014 with Crimea. As soon as it annexed that territory, it reminded the world that it considers it part of Russia, and Russian territory is subject to being defended with Russia's nuclear arsenal. This is an attempt to get everyone to back down and become afraid. And my concern is when Russia has put itself out now on this limb, and Ukraine doesn't stop, they've already said that they won't, Russia has a need to lash out. They could expand the scope of cyber attacks, although they haven't been particularly effective. They could launch additional missile strikes in different places on Ukraine. They could attempt to interfere with satellites that are providing support before they get to the nuclear stage. But when they do, even then, they are most likely to signal in different ways, like conducting exercises, maybe potentially even some practice launch activity. But I do think that it's a greater than zero chance that this kind of nuclear rhetoric is going to sharpen over time.
Dara, how concerned should we be that Putin is clearly on the back foot with this announcement, with this call-up? Or is it a good sign that there seems to be a path to the war's end?
The fact that they have called up a partial mobilization to me suggests that they still feel like they have an operational play on the battlefield. If they didn't think that it would help them or stave off defeat, I think they would have skipped this step. But I don't really at this point see either side of anyone involved in this wanting to find a way out at this point. If anything, I find there's sunk costs on all sides to continue.
Dara Masiko is a senior policy researcher at the RAND Corporation. She was helping us understand Vladimir Putin's announcement of a mobilization of some 300,000 troops to fight in Ukraine. Dara, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
The recent death of a 22-year-old woman in the custody of Iran's so-called morality police led to protests across the country. They are still in the streets. Videos from various demonstrations around Iran are being posted on social media. This one on Twitter came from a protest in the northern Iranian city of Sari. In it, women are dancing and burning their hijabs. Mehsa Amini, the woman who died in custody, had been detained for not wearing her hijab tightly enough. Joining me now from Washington is Susan Tamasebi. She's Iranian and executive director of Femina, an NGO that supports women human rights defenders in the Middle East and North Africa. Susan, it's always remarkable to see spontaneous protests in Iran, and this one seems especially dramatic. What is it about the death of Mehsa Amini in the custody of the morality police that has so galvanized Iranians?
Well, Mehsa Amini's death has really sparked a great level of anger among a broad segment of Iranians. I think Iranian women are very angry because they're tired, they're really sick and tired of having their bodies and their dress controlled by morality police. They're frustrated and angry about the level of violence with which that control is being exerted, and they've just had enough.
At this point, are these protests still mostly women? Are they getting any support from men? And what does that look like?
Well, from the start, the protests have been both men and women. You know, the pictures that we see and the reports that we're getting include a larger number of women, but men are also protesting. And, you know, I should say that depending on the city and depending on the reports that we're getting, it's not just women who are opposed to the veil as a personal choice, but there are also veiled women who are part of these protests that are opposed to the controlling of women in this way. So the protesters are extremely brave, and they are, you know, demonstrating their anger and their frustration through acts that we probably never would have imagined, like burning their hijab, dancing in the streets.
Are protesters being detained for what they're doing?
Yes, both protesters are being detained, and also women's rights activists are being detained, and some male human rights defenders have also been detained.
It is hard to imagine, and I don't know whether there's even any polling about this, but let's say there is a softening of the rules in Iran around the obligatory hijab. Do you see a majority of Iranian women and men yearning to rid themselves of any of these strict rules established by the clerics, or is this a vocal minority?
No, this is definitely a majority of women. And probably a majority of men would also agree that the obligatory hijab laws should end and the violent enforcement should end. I'd like us to see it, and I encourage people to see this a little bit broader than just hijab. This is about women's bodily rights and their bodily autonomy. And, you know, especially this younger generation cannot stand the idea and is very critical of the idea, the notion that their bodies should be controlled by laws, by the state, by others. And whether that means that the way that they're dressing, or it means how many children they should have, or if they should have children, you know, these are all issues that are of serious concern, especially to this younger generation. And it's the greatest symbol and the most visible symbol of it is the hijab. But we had a law that was passed in November that seriously undermines women's reproductive choices. And I think people are protesting this notion of controlling women's bodies in this way.
Suzanne, how unprecedented are these protests? I mean, is there a history of women protesting against or resisting mandatory rules about their bodies and hijab since the 79 revolution?
You know, women have resisted mandatory hijab for four decades. So they have never, ever succumbed to the way that the Islamic State wanted to have the women dress. So, and I think in recent years, there's been a lot more resistance. We've had women walking out in the street without hijab, sending their videos and pictures in. But even before that, women were walking around without the hijab oftentimes, even if they weren't filming themselves and joining protests, but they were doing this on a regular basis in their cars and any opportunities that they had, they would take off their hijab. So it's not unprecedented in that sense that women protest the hijab. But what is really unprecedented is the fact that this is the first time that we see a broad base of Iranians gathering around, going into the streets and making demands on behalf of women. So we've had women doing this. We've had women human rights defenders organizing protests and a small group of women who are more educated or more concerned with women's issues or joining them. But we've never had this broad base of support, you know, men and women alike in several different provinces coming into the streets, making a demand on behalf of women. And so in that sense, I think it's extremely unprecedented and also extremely important because people give lip service to women's situation. And when they criticize the Islamic Republic of Iran, they criticize the status of women. But rarely are people ever willing to take risks to try to change the status quo. So this is unprecedented in that sense.
Suzanne Tamasebi is a longtime Iranian women's rights activist speaking with us about the rise of unprecedented protests by women and men across Iran. Suzanne, thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. The German government is undertaking a major move to keep its natural gas market under control. It took ownership of a European gas company and is standing by a new tax on gas customers. The World's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler is here with more on this and to bring us, as she often does, how this all fits into the context of climate change. So, Carolyn, Germany nationalized its company Uniper. What exactly does that mean?
The German government is taking over a 99% ownership stake in the company at a cost of 8.5 billion euros to save it from bankruptcy. What happened to the company is that when Russia reduced its flows of gas to Europe, it, along with many other companies, was forced to buy gas on the more expensive short-term spot market, so it's lost billions. Germany's economy and climate minister today said that this bailout is necessary to save the company, which is the country's largest gas importer.
And then there's this new gas tax in Germany. How much is that?
So gas customers in Germany are going to start paying a few cents per kilowatt hour extra starting on October 1st. That's estimated to add up to several hundred euros per year per family on these energy bills. And this is just one of many measures that European governments are taking right now to support both citizens and energy companies as they both struggle with really high energy prices. So lots of other European countries, including France and the UK and Spain and Portugal, are putting caps on energy prices for households. Usually the government is making up the difference in these prices. All of this government support is seen as important in one way, essential in one way, but also controversial because of its climate impacts.
Right. Explain that.
So European countries and many other countries have repeatedly said over the years that they're going to phase out fossil fuel subsidies. So stop using government money to pay for coal, oil, and gas tax breaks and other subsidies in an effort to reduce their production and consumption of fossil fuels to combat climate change. And that is exactly what all of these policy measures are, right? Government bailouts for gas companies, taxes going to gas companies, price caps. These are all fossil fuel subsidies in one form or another. And a huge increase in them is expected this year. That's according to Ipek Gencsu, who tracks global fossil fuel subsidies at ODI, a London-based global affairs think tank.
This is quite a tricky position to be in because obviously people do need support to support them through the energy bills and the rising cost of living. But at the same time, these are continuing to provide support to the fossil fuel industry. So it's just continuing our attachment to fossil fuels.
Well, Carolyn, she said it right there. It's tricky. If gas stops flowing to Europe or people can't afford to pay their bills, they could freeze this winter or at least be in very unpleasant conditions. What is the alternative?
Well, there have been some suggestions about how to support consumers without working against climate goals. For example, yesterday, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for governments to enact a windfall tax on oil and gas companies and use that money to help support vulnerable citizens. A leader at the International Monetary Fund has argued that the full cost of energy should be passed on to consumers to try to incentivize energy efficiency. And then governments should just provide very targeted funding to lower-income households. So that's another idea. A third argument is that money going to gas companies could be going to insulation efforts or to finance rooftop solar or heat pumps for consumers. But back to Germany, the energy ministry there says they're doing all of that. The expansion of renewable energy, energy savings, and energy efficiency remain, quote, the most important cornerstones of German energy policy, but that expanding renewables can't happen at the required speed to, quote, remedy the current energy crisis.
The World's Environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
In my house these days, I need a whole strategy for trash disposal. If I even think about dropping a banana peel or watermelon rind in the bin, it's like the ants outside somehow know and are mobilizing for an overnight attack. I know I'm not alone because a headline from a report out this week in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences is an assessment of the global ant population, 20 quadrillion. I don't even know how many zeros that is. Let's just make it simple. For every human on Earth, there are approximately 2.5 million ants. Sabina Newton is an insect ecologist at the University of Würzburg in Germany. Sabina, you co-authored this study. I have to ask, why count ants and how did you do it?
Well, ants are incredible creatures. They occur almost everywhere and they live in all sorts of environments. While there are many studies out there which look at species richness and diversity over large global gradients, there were very few studies looking at abundance as such. It's not only important how many species you have, the sheer number of the ants also matter.
Mm. Well, as you said, ants are native to almost every corner of the planet. And though I and many others may complain about ants in our kitchens, the many ant species out there, they're more beneficial than they are a nuisance. What is their ecological importance? How do ants help us and the planet?
Ants help us and the planet in many different ways by performing all these important biological tasks, from aerating the soil, helping with nutrient cycling, for example, removing the banana from your kitchen floor, disperse seeds and remove that plant matter and animal matter. So they're a key player in the environments out there.
Can you talk a bit about the process of actually counting them and how you come up with 20 quadrillion ants on planet Earth? I know that's an estimate, but still.
So we used a range of studies who were basically collecting ants using a very standardized method. So either they collected ants over a given time period with something which is called a pitfall trap, or they would collect ants from a square meter of leaf litter and then count all the ants which were living in this area. And from that kind of standardized methods, we can basically upscale to the global surface of the Earth and make calculations based on that in different tropical, non-tropical areas, in different habitats, and so on.
So there are over 10,000 species of ants around the planet. How diverse are they, like size-wise, and what they actually do for us?
Ants are incredibly diverse. They differ in size across 1 to 2 orders of magnitude. The tiniest ant, for example, is less than a millimeter large, and the largest ant is a couple of centimeters large. That's incredible. Then they come in very different forms and functions. They can have long legs and very spiny surfaces, or they can be totally smooth and very slender, that they fit through all holes and crevices in the soil where some of them live.
Sabina, what's your favorite thing about ants?
My favorite thing about ants is that they can have an incredible, amazing behavior. For example, if you're in a park and you have a picnic and you lose a few crumbs of cookies or something, ants might come on their searching, foraging trip, and they find this cookie, and then they can go straight home back to their nest. Wherever they are in nature, they can find home to their nest immediately by using something like a sun compass.
Do you think ants are underappreciated?
I think in the scientific world, ants are very much appreciated. But for many of us who only encounter ants when they invade the kitchen, they are a little bit underappreciated. The mass of global ants outweighs wild mammals and wild birds by far. So whenever you're going to go for a walk in a forest or in a park and appreciate mammals and birds, you might consider that there are actually many more ants walking around just where you walk on the ground as well. And we might need to appreciate them a little bit more.
Sabina Newton is an insect ecologist speaking with us about a new study she was part of looking at the quadrillions of ants that grace our planet. She joined us from the Canary Islands. Sabina, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Nearly 500,000 students, mostly from Africa and parts of Asia, went to universities in China. Then COVID hit. Many of those foreign students are still trying to get back to campus.
Sometimes the family has sacrificed to put a young person into university, so they put their hopes in China.
But Chinese authorities are not making the return easy. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. President Biden came to New York today for the UN General Assembly. During his turn at the podium, he focused much of his remarks on the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
This war is about extinguishing Ukraine's right to exist as a state, plain and simple, and Ukraine's right to exist as a people.
Biden also spoke about nuclear proliferation, global food insecurity, and competition with China. The president was one of several dozen world leaders speaking today in New York. Stuart Patrick has been following the annual event. He's a senior fellow and director of the Global Order and Institutions Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Stuart, what do you make of President Biden's speech today? What do you think he set out to do, and did he do it?
I thought he did a very good job. I think in particular in the way that he talked about the competition with China, in the way he held out some hope for the developing world, and in the way he sort of recommitted the United States to climate change. But I think the most important thing was his framing of the war that Vladimir Putin has launched in Ukraine as a fundamental violation of the Charter of the United Nations, as opposed to some big new Cold War between the United States and the West against Russia and implicitly China.
I mean, Ukraine has been high on the agenda all this week at the UN General Assembly. Biden today also weighed in, not surprisingly, condemning Russia for violating Ukraine's sovereignty.
A permanent member of the United Nations Security Council invaded its neighbor, attempted to erase a sovereign state from the map. Russia has shamelessly violated the core tenets of the United Nations Charter.
And in shining a bright light on the Russian war in Ukraine, Biden puts the war in front of the Great Hall in New York, and not just the Security Council. How relevant is the UN today if it's failing to stop a member of the UN Security Council from starting a war?
you know, this has been the Achilles heel of the United Nations since it was founded. What Joe Biden did, which I thought was quite interesting, was to basically say, look, Russia is, first of all, it's in total violation of the fundamental tenets of the Charter, as the clip suggested, and there needs to be some accountability. He also held out the prospect of UN Security Council enlargement. He committed the United States to supporting the enlargement of the UN Security Council in both its permanent membership and its non-permanent membership. And he also importantly said that there should be greater restraint in the use of the veto.
So President Biden also addressed competition with China as a global superpower. What did he say and what did you make of his remarks?
I thought the fact that he said that we don't seek conflict with China, we do not seek a new Cold War, we're not trying to force countries to choose between us and any other country. At the same time, you know, we're going to be in support of a free, open, and prosperous world. So the United States is sticking to its principles, but it's also recognizing the need for some coexistence with China. So he reaffirmed the one China policy, which again will leave some scratching their heads because he's had some relatively provocative statements recently, including on 60 Minutes this last weekend, about the willingness of the United States to defend Taiwan in the case of a Chinese attack. So a lot of ambiguity, and not just strategic ambiguity, in terms, I think, still remaining in terms of U.S. relations with China. But he tried to at least suggest that peaceful coexistence is a possibility.
So, Stuart, there are 37 speakers listed today at the U.N., including the presidents of Libya, Kenya, and Iran. Anything else stand out for you from the General Assembly today?
Well, you know, obviously the Iranian president calling for, you know, basically saying that the U.S. effort of maximum pressure was destined to fail and that this was a militaristic activity on the part of the U.S. president. The one thing that I would say is that throughout a number of the speeches is you have heard repeatedly this desire, and I think President Biden tried to speak to it, that countries do not want to get caught in a new bipolar confrontation or Cold War. And they want to, particularly countries in the developing world, you heard it from the president of Senegal, Macky Sall, yesterday, that there's no desire for alignment. And I think that that's something that the United States needs to take seriously.
I mean, you've covered the UN General Assembly for many years. Is that a good sign that there seems to be this desire for unity, not for polarization?
Absolutely. The signals that we need to have unity and that we need to be able to compartmentalize our ideological and other differences is very important. We need to learn to walk and chew gum at the same time, to use that cliche, and that, you know, we can still have our disagreements over the Taiwan Strait or over trade policy, et cetera. But on certain issues, we need to be able to bracket those off so that we can actually make some progress on some of the calamitous trends that the UN Secretary General outlined in his opening speech to the General Assembly yesterday.
Stuart Patrick is a senior fellow and director of the Global Order and Institutions Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, joining us to discuss today's proceedings at the UN General Assembly in New York. Stuart, thanks so much.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you, Marco.
They put their hopes in China. Now they're shut out. I'm talking about hundreds of thousands of international students. Before COVID emerged in China in late 2019, nearly 500,000 foreign students, mostly from Africa and other parts of Asia, studied at universities there. Then everything changed. As The World's Rebecca Canther reports from Shanghai, many students are still being prevented from going back to campus.
21-year-old Harinitesh Savakumar is an undergrad at Hebei Medical University. It was cheaper than studying at a private university in his home country of India. But just a few months after arriving in 2019, news started spreading about a virus from Wuhan. Harinitesh says he decided to fly home for winter break and wait it out.
We had expected that we would stay out of the university for around 2 to 3 months, but we didn't expect it would go this long.
More than 2.5 years later, Harinitesh is still taking classes online. He wants to return to China to finish his degree, but his university says it's waiting for permission from the Chinese government. Harinitesh says he's worried that his career goal of becoming a doctor is getting derailed.
Just having a theory knowledge is not going to help you treat a patient in real life. So you need to have that clinical and physical experience too. That's what we are lagging, and that's what we are striving to get back to.
Harinitesh is among hundreds of thousands of international students whose futures are on the line. They're attending classes from home, waiting to get permission to return to their universities in China. On Twitter, they've been using the hashtag #TakeUsBackToChina to call attention to their situation. Curtis Chin is a former U.S. ambassador to the Asian Development Bank. He heard about the Twitter campaign and has been advocating for the students.
These are not rich kids necessarily. Sometimes the family has sacrificed to put a young person into university. And clearly they might have liked them to have gone to the U.S., but China provided a closer, cost-effective, and still competitive education. So they put their hopes in China.
Students from some countries have had an easier time getting permission to return, he says. And it's not clear why.
China has wanted to position itself as a rival, as an equal to other places like the United States and Europe and Australia that have been seen as sources of education, as a way to move up. In many ways, China's closing its borders to international students has been a big soft power failure.
Many students say they're struggling to attend classes from different time zones or on shaky internet connections. Lin Lim is a second-year design student from Malaysia who finally arrived in China.
It's a very long journey. I'm quite lucky. That's what I've been telling myself all this way. It takes so much work to get into China, and then after you get into China, you still have to do more and more work to get to school and to be able to attend classes.
She flew back on a charter flight of 300 students. The Malaysian government helped pay for it. Most students aren't so lucky, though. Purushottam Sobedi is from Nepal. He's a second-year civil engineering student, and he says the price of flights back to China is now 10 times what it was before the pandemic.
There is one problem that's too expensive.
When students are able to return, they're expected to cover flight costs and up to 21 days of mandatory quarantine in a hotel. That can run into the thousands of dollars. And despite the government's announcement, many students on Twitter say nothing has changed. Their universities still won't give them the permission letters they need to reapply for student visas. Philip Altbach is a professor at Boston College's Center for International Higher Education. He says unlike American universities, Chinese universities don't depend on tuition from international students, many of whom are on full scholarship. Bringing them back is simply not a priority, he says.
All of this, like everything in China, is top down. So if the authorities say, hey guys, do it, it'll take them some time, but they'll do it. The policies could change.
Until then, he says, international students enrolled in Chinese universities will be forced to make a difficult choice. They can hope for the best and keep waiting for a chance to return to China. Or they just give up and start their college education all over again, somewhere else. For The World, I'm Rebecca Kanther in Shanghai.
500 years ago today, a book was published in Germany that changed the course of European history, a translation of the New Testament that kicked the Protestant Reformation into high gear and also ignited a century of religious wars. But out of the rubble, modern Europe would arise. From Frankfurt, David Kattenberg has a story of this book and its impact on the globe.
The bells of the old Nikolai Church in Frankfurt, Germany. Martin Luther likely heard them in the spring of 1521 as he headed home from a scary encounter with the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V. Charles wanted Luther to apologize for the scandalous things he'd written about the Pope and his church. Luther refused and was now in deep trouble. 16 months after that fateful encounter, in September 1522, Martin Luther's most subversive work, a popular German translation of the New Testament, was sold for the first time, shaking church and empire to their foundations. Buchgasse.
That's the Buchgasse, the Book Lane. Book Lane.
I walked down Frankfurt's Book Lane with Jeff Myers, a retired American pastor.
So, like, you know, 500 years ago, Martin Luther's New Testament was sold on this street?
It was sold out very, very quickly and cost between 1/2 and 1.5 gulden, which I'm told is about the cost of a refrigerator today, about the cost of a refrigerator to buy a small New Testament from Martin Luther.
Martin Luther was already a successful author when he translated the New Testament here at Wartburg Castle, high above the town of Eisenach in central Germany.
The drawbridge.
Indeed, 70 years after the invention of the printing press, Luther's writings had turned book publishing into a huge industry.
Big door.
The big door.
Dorothee Menke is a researcher at the Wartburg.
He's laying down his principles for translation. And there he says, you have to talk like the woman in the house, like the children on the street, like the man in the market. It was to be heard in church, and it's a very musical language.
Luther's translation would be a huge hit. For the first time, ordinary Germans could read gospel themselves rather than paying priests to read it for them in Latin.
For the people living in the 16th century, it was revelation, the revelation of the Word of God.
Thomas Kaufmann is a Luther scholar at the University of Göttingen.
So now God has revealed and talked to the people. Now Christ is speaking to them by the New Testament.
So it democratized.
Yeah, in a certain sense, of course, yeah. It democratized.
Luther's translation did more than just democratize faith. It promoted literacy, the birth of the modern German language, and the creation of the first public schools.
Indeed, the New Testament was a pillar of early modern education and, in a certain sense, even emancipation of people. And in many cases, it was the only book they had in the households, and they grew up by reading the holy texts in the translation of Martin Luther.
Luther's translation also promoted spiritual debate, a new experience for pious Christians.
If you compare it to Jewish communities, they always lived with the holy texts. There's no Jewish identity without dealing with Hebrew texts. Not so in Christianity. So the New Testament became something you could argue with.
Argue indeed. Those who embraced Luther demanded sovereignty from emperor and pope, sowing seeds for the modern nation state where everyone could worship as they pleased. Today, Germans continue to read Martin Luther's New Testament and celebrate the courage it took to publish it. Some see Luther as a model for generations of dissidents walking in Luther's footsteps. Others talk about Luther's dark side, most notably his vicious anti-Semitism.
Martin Luther, he has kind of two legs, yeah? The one leg stepping into modernity, but the other leg is in the Middle Ages, yeah?
Harold Storch is a retired dean of the Protestant Church in Germany.
I personally would see him more as an ambivalent phenomenon, like the problem with the Jews, and he was not against burning witches.
Across the lands where Martin Luther wandered and wrote, German Protestants celebrate the great reformer's positive achievements. A 250-mile Luther Trail has been set up, tracing Luther's path to Wartburg Castle and his New Testament. On the Luther Trail in Frankfurt, Jeff Myers reflects on why people should care.
We often ask people who are doing reflective walking tours with us on the Luther Trail, what am I standing for? Where do I want to courageously take my stand, whether it's in my personal faith or at the place where I work, as Luther did 500 years ago.
500 years after the publication of Martin Luther's New Testament, the book is available in over 1,500 languages and much cheaper than a fridge, a steady source of inspiration for a billion Protestants and for all those who dare to speak truth to power. For the world, I'm David Kattenberg.
The nominations for Latin Grammys were announced last night.
Mejor Nuevo Artista.
There were the shoo-ins, the snubs, and the surprises. Big surprises like 94-year-old Ángela Álvarez being nominated for Best New Artist. The World spoke to the producer of the album, who also happens to be Ángela's grandson, Carlos José Álvarez. He told us his earliest memories of his grandmother were of music.
She would always grab the guitar at family gatherings, Christmas, whatever it was. She had this like desperation to sing for us.
Camino sin rumbo, qué pena me da. Camino sin rumbo.
I thought everyone just had a grandma who sang to them. It was just like a normal thing.
Yo busco consuelo, yo busco la paz. Camino sin rumbo.
And it basically wasn't until later in my life, as I kind of was in college and, you know, began to pursue my dreams as a film composer, I got really, really curious about all those songs that she would sing to me. And I called her up and I said, I call her Nana, and I said, Nana, I'm going to come to your house. And I'm going to bring a microphone. I'm going to stick it in front of you. And for a weekend, and I want you to sing me the songs you've written. Tell me what they're about. You know, I expected maybe 8 or 9, 10 songs. And I get there, I set the microphone. Okay, Nana, so, let's do this. And she walks out of her bedroom with like a stack of notebooks. And she's like, yeah, I was counting and I think I have 40 songs that I've written. And I was like, wait, what? Because I'm a composer and I knew that she had written her songs and everything, but I didn't know the extent of it. It quickly became obvious to me that these songs were like a diary of her life, basically. She wrote them to cope.
Ángela had a tumultuous life. When the Cuban Revolution began in 1960, she sent her 4 young children to the United States alone as part of Operation Pedro Pan. That was a Cold War program that airlifted more than 14,000 children out of Cuba and placed them in American foster homes and orphanages. Her grandson said Ángela would not see her children again for another 4 years.
En mi jardín de amores. Tengo un hermoso vergel.
There's one song that she wrote in Mi Jardín, which is in my garden. She's kind of remembering the time in Cuba with her children, and she personifies flowers as her children.
Yo no las quiero perder, y con ternura le ofrezco mi más profundo querer.
She says, in my garden of love, there's a lovely patch of flowers. I pride in watching them grow. I shower them with sweet kisses. I wish not to see them go. And with tenderness, I offer the most intimate care.
No quiero ver las marchitas, ni ver sus pétalos caer. Mis flores me necesitan.
Ángela always wanted to be a musician. She told her story in a documentary Carlos made about her life.
I have about 15 years old, and I said, went to my father, may I sing a song with the mariachi? And then he said, okay. And then I talked with the mariachi, I sing a song. And then the mariachi said, wow, we like that you sing for us in our mariachi. Then I feel that I could be famous, but my father say, no.
I guess he didn't want his daughter in nightclubs back in the, she was born in 1927, so this was a different time. And he was always very supportive and loving of her. But he said, you can sing for the family, but I don't want you singing for the public. And, it's not the right place for you. And so her dream was kind of crushed. What became present to me in that weekend when she was playing these songs for me and telling me what they're about is that she was like a frustrated artist. She wanted this. She wanted this so bad. And I think it's partly why she pushed me so hard to pursue my dreams, because she never had the chance to.
Pedacito de patria. Pedacito de cielo.
So I went back to LA and I got off the plane. I remember calling her from the taxi to my house, and I said, Nana, do you want to go into a studio and record your songs? You know, would you want to do this? And she was just like, yes, oh my gosh. And she said, I'll never forget it. She said, you know, my wish is to leave this life knowing that somehow my music would live on.
So later, Carlos called up his friends he had worked with in Hollywood over the years, some of the biggest names in Cuban music, and asked them if they would help record his grandmother's songs. The answer was a resounding yes. The album is called simply Ángela Álvarez. One reviewer said the music collapses time and space and puts the listener back into the golden age of Cuban music. The songs she composed over the years lament loss, but also have a note of fiery defiance. They celebrate love, family, and life. Carlos says the album, the documentary, the Grammy nod, it's all been a whirlwind for his grandmother.
This has all been very, I think, surprising for her. She never in a million years thought this was going to happen, that she was going to be able to record her album and have her music live on like this. She's not on social media, so, you know, to really have her experience, you know, people coming up to her and saying, I heard your music. I think it is just, you know, given her this incredible amount of energy and happiness and feeling that she's complete. You know, she just wanted to be able to know that her friends and family and people could hear her music, and now it's just happening on this global scale.
In Angela's own words,
if I die in an hour, I'll die happy.
And you make us happy too, Angela, and inspire us that it's never too late to accomplish our dreams.
Hay mucho se sufre, hay mucho se llora.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
From PRX.